Hello, everybody. This is Salman Asghari. Welcome to Talk Iran, a podcast dedicated to discussing and debating Iran-related issues. As some of you know, I started a podcast called The Hyphenated American a few months ago, where I interviewed prominent Iranian Americans to shine a light on their accomplishments and to generally counter the rise of anti-immigrant sentiments in the U.S. One of those people was Dr. Abbas Milani, a well-known Iran expert and an accomplished author and historian. Iran has always been an area of interest for me. But after my conversation with Dr. Milani, I started looking more closely into Iran-related matters. As you know, there's been a lot going on with Iran lately. Donald Trump withdrew the U.S. from the Iran nuclear deal, there have been some protests in the country, and there's a major economic crisis going on there. As I read more and looked at social media, I noticed a big fracture in the Iranian-American community. On the one hand, there are people who support the Trump administration's increased efforts against the Islamic Republic and are advocating for the complete ouster of the regime. On the other hand, there are people who think any activity or any kind of pressure from the outside, whether it's from the U.S. or other groups, strengthens the hand of the hardliners and will at the end of the day work against the interests of the Iranian nation. That anything meaningful has to happen from the inside. I'm simplifying things, of course. There are many other people with different opinions and others who fall somewhere in between these two poles. What's been concerning for me is how people choose to engage one another on these topics, especially on social media. People place themselves in these camps, they hurl insults, they question one another's motives and affiliations. This surely can't be the best way to come up with good ideas and to collaborate. So I've decided to create an open forum where we discuss and debate these ideas in a respectful manner. I think open discourse through long-form conversations is the answer to our social media-fueled divisiveness. It's the only way we can let the best ideas win. That's why I'm changing the name of the podcast from The Hyphenated American to Talk Iran. I want to focus exclusively on these issues at this point. I may at some point go back to the old format, but I'll let things evolve as they may. I have a lot of my own views, and I'm not a journalist, but I'm going to do my best to provide an objective point of view and to invite people with different ideas and perspectives. I've already reached out to many journalists, policy experts, analysts, and academics with a focus on Iran, and have received a lot of interest. I've completed several episodes to date, so I'm going to release them back-to-back in the next several days, after which I'll probably try to maintain a one-episode-per-week schedule. So my guest today is Borzu Daragahi. He's an independent journalist covering the Middle East and North Africa. He's also a non-resident senior fellow at the Atlantic Council, which is a D.C.-based think tank. A three-time finalist for the Pulitzer Prize in International Reporting for his coverage of Iran and Iraq, he contributes regularly to Foreign Policy, The Atlantic, and The Daily Beast. His work has also appeared in numerous other publications. He also appears on English-language radio and television around the world to provide commentary and reporting. Borzu and I talked about the Trump administration's recent efforts in regards to Iran, the role of the Iranian diaspora, various pathways for change in Iran, the social media environment, and other topics. He strongly believes that change in Iran has to be initiated from the inside, that the diaspora is disconnected from what's actually happening on the ground in terms of the day-to-day back and forth between the various factions and the people, that we're creating our own narrative on the outside that's not really realistic or helpful. I won't steal his thunder any more than I have and let you hear it in his own words. So without further ado, I give you Borzu Daragahi. I'm here with Borzu Daragahi. Borzu, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you so much.
All right, there's a lot going on with Iran these days, so I'm going to dive right into the issues. The Trump administration has undertaken a renewed maximum pressure campaign against the Iranian government. As part of this effort, on July 22nd, this last weekend, at an event in Southern California titled Supporting Iranian Voices, U.S. Secretary of State Mike Pompeo addressed a crowd of Iranian Americans and listed outrageous examples of corruption amongst high-ranking officials in Iran, also talked about the suffering of the Iranian people under the regime, and voiced his support for the cause of the Iranian people. Many Iranian Americans are divided and have voiced their opinions on social media and elsewhere on whether or not we should support the efforts of the administration. Regime change advocates have said that Iranian people are crying out for support. We didn't listen to them in 2009. They wanted the support of the Obama administration. yes, Trump is unstable. America doesn't have the best record in the region. But if the U.S. actually wants to bring democracy to Iran, which is what we all want at the end of the day, then we should unite behind the administration. What's wrong with that argument?
Well, I mean, first of all, you're talking about the Trump administration. This is a government that doesn't really even seem to be committed to democracy in the U.S. You know, I, as a journalist, can sort of speak to this, the worries that we have in the media and the journalism community, and not just among, print journalists such as me, like big broadcast media, huge news organizations, really worried about the tone of the Trump administration. So, if they're not committed to democracy in the U.S., how are they committed to democracy in Iran? And in addition, you have this sort of, the Trump administration doesn't seem to be committed to democracy as a general principle for, the countries of the region. I'm not just an Iran correspondent. I cover the region in general. And I can tell you that there are places that are, in terms of corruption, in terms of rule of law, in terms of human rights abuses, freedom of press, freedom of speech, that are much worse than Iran in right. the region, in the Middle East. And, the U.S. is selling them weapons. We're talking about Egypt. We're talking about Saudi Arabia and other countries as well, other parts of the region. And so it just seems rather precious to talk about democracy on the part of the Trump administration when, clearly they don't seem to have much of a commitment to democracy at home or anywhere else abroad. And to many people, many smart people, many people watching what's going on in the region, it seems that the U.S. is, back to this old game of using the democracy and human rights cudgel as a weapon against governments it doesn't like. Right. And, people should see through that. People should see through that kind of facade. I would say also, just the nature of this particular event, it was called Supporting Iranian Voices. But, I looked through the transcript of the thing and watched it on video, and I didn't see any Iranian voices. I didn't hear any Iranian voices. Apparently, there was like an off-the-record dinner at some point where, Iranians got a chance to talk to Pompeo and, Tom Cotton and these folks. But we didn't get access to that. So what Iranian voices were supported, I'll stop there and let you ask another question.
Yeah, I saw the back and forth you had on Twitter, and I want to get to that at some point as well. But I want to ask you, is it necessarily the Trump administration or is it the U.S. government in general that has misguided policies? Because let's say Bernie Sanders was in power and he was saying, I support the Iranian cause, then what?
Well, I would just say, as someone who's been covering the region for a long time through, numerous administrations, that does make a difference, And as someone who's been around a while, actually, in general, when the Democrats are in power, they tend to be more consistent about, upholding general principles instead of spouting, some lines. That just seems to be the pattern. And you can see that, during Barack Obama's administration. During Bill Clinton's administration, there was, more than just lip service to issues of human rights and democracy in countries that are U.S. allies. Not that they're perfect. No one's perfect. Not that there's not a level of pragmatism. Not that they would, sacrifice alliances over it. But you see that it's a little bit more serious and a little bit more when it comes to Iran, examining what's actually going on in the ground instead of sitting around whispering with a bunch of, bitter exiles who have not been to their country in 40 years and have no idea what it's about and what sorts of political dynamics are there.
What about the argument that the reformists are done? The likes of Rouhani, Zarif, Khatami were all full of empty promises. They capitulated to the hardliners at every turn. And there's really no hope in terms of somebody coming in internally and trying to reform things.
I would say two things to that. I think there's a level of ignorance there. They're not really watching Iran day to day. They don't see the little fights that are going on constantly, the little battles, the back and forths, the two steps forward, one step back, or sometimes one step forward, two steps back. that is going on a daily basis there. And, you know, this is a real politics. They're, you know, at each other's throats and so on. I would not say that the moderates are dead or have capitulated. They just, you know, there's an ongoing battle there, and you can see it. You can read about it, you know, if you watch closely and, you know, listen to their words, listen to their, you know, internal discussions, listen to the let's give an example.
Mm-hmm.
OK, you know, usually when you have, you know, little demonstrations around the country over the past few years, you know, when it was under Ahmadinejad, he just crushed them. He would just like bring out the batons and start beating the shit out of these people, the IRGC. But in recent months, you've seen like all these demonstrations taking place. And, you know, there's a totally different strategy. You see the Rouhani administration really trying to desecuritize protests is the word that they're using. And this is, they're talking about it like this. Mm-hmm. They're saying that, you know, let's make protests a normal thing. People get upset. They organize protests. It's in the Iranian constitution that people should be able to protest. And so, you know, they're allowing these protests to happen, you know? So that's one thing. So that's one point that I would make. It's just that there is, it's just not accurate what they're saying. And then the second thing I would say, and I think this is really important, is that it's like, seriously, what other choice is there? I mean, I travel to Iran pretty regularly, or used to, rather, for reasons that I can't really talk about publicly. I'm not going back in recent years, in the last couple of years. But, you know, I mean, people in Iran, they don't want a cataclysmic, bloody event to bring about change. You know, this is primarily a aspiring middle class country where people are having like two or three kids. They don't want their kids to be martyred on the streets or in a civil war. And when you talk about violent regime change, when you talk about, you know, anything other than reform, you know, that's what you're talking about. And, you know, I mean, that's easy for some, you know, dentist in, you know, the suburbs of L.A., you know, to sort of cheer on bloodletting and conflict in a country that he basically has only an emotional connection to.
Right.
But, you know, that's a tough thing to impose on a people in a struggling, developing country who are, you know, maybe just barely getting by and have found a level of, you know, comfort and so on in their lives.
Right, right. But the argument there is that to minimize bloodshed, there are certain hallmarks of democratic transition that we can learn from and implement for a peaceful transition. For example, we can learn from what happened with the fall of communism, the end of the apartheid regime in South Africa, and what happened afterwards. So there are steps that we can take. We can, you know, write a constitution. We can plan a
really
peaceful
good,
transition, so to speak.
Those examples that you mentioned, South Africa and Eastern Europe, are all examples when, you know, the sort of huge segment of the elite, you know, in the case of both South Africa and definitely in the case of communism. I was in Berlin in 1989, believe it or not, that's how old I am.
Mm-hmm.
and, you know, you had, you know, a huge segment of the elite defect and join the opposition. And that's how these things happen. You know, in the case of South Africa, you know, which was extremely bloody, actually, let's not forget that that was a very bloody transition those first few years. You know, you had the whole, like, you know, three quarters of the white elite basically signed on to, you know, Nelson Mandela's agenda. You know, I mean, these are big, you know, cataclysmic changes. Those people in, like, I don't know, Los Angeles and D.C., they're not talking about, like, reaching out to the segment of the elite and so on. What are they even talking about? What's the game plan? What's the, you know, what are you going to do? You're going to go in there? How are you going to, you know, take this government that has, you know, at least, let's be conservative, 500,000 armed, trained shock troops? And you're going to, you know, how are you going to overthrow it? How are you going to get those people to put down their weapons? You know, I mean, there's only one way to do that. And that's through sort of a gradual reform process that eventually leads to some kind of breakthrough. You know, like, let's say Rouhani's, you know, successor or Rouhani's successor's successor becomes a supreme leader and, you know, decides that we're going to slowly transition towards a different system and so on. You know, other than that, it just, the regime change people have no plan. They have no step-by-step process by which this will happen, except for, you know, a foreign invasion, which no one really wants.
Yeah, the argument that resonated with me was the fact that we need cultural and structural reform as well. And if we have regime change without the cultural and structural reform, then we're back, you know, to where we were.
You know, I mean, I think that, you know, again, I don't want to get too much into political science and so on, but, you know, I actually read a lot of, you know, good experts on Iran. And one person to read is this guy in New York City, New York University. He's at Baruch or one of those universities. His name is Ervand Ibrahimian, and you should have him on your show once.
Okay.
And you read his books, and what he really gets at is like the continuity in trends between, you know, the Qajar time and the Shah's time and the Islamic Republic's time. And, yeah. It, you know, he sort of explores how, and you have these sort of startling moments reading his stuff, how, you know, it's always been the same struggles in Iran, you know, the sort of battles between rural and urban, between the intelligentsia and the masses, between the, sort of centralizing impulse of the government and the fragmenting, decentralizing power of you know, events and destruction and wars and so on and so forth. And, you know, he sort of fits the Islamic Republic into a narrative, you know, that shows that it kind of makes sense that they would go in this direction. And that's like, I think that another thing that we should look at, you know, in terms of taking big steps and looking at, you know, what happens in this region. You have, like, for example, in the 60s and, you know, 50s and 60s, the rise of communism in Indochina. And that was just like something that happened, and it had to play itself out. And it went and it, you know, took over the region. And now, you know, you have China, Vietnam, you know, other countries, Cambodia, Laos, who went in this sort of communistic collectivizing direction and so on. And then you had the same sort of thing happening in the Middle East, these broad movements, you know, this Islamization of the region, the rise of Islamic politics. It happened. You know, there's no way of denying it. You know, after the collapse and failure of the sort of post-war nationalisms that, you know, took over some of these countries, you're inevitably going to get, you know, this Islamic trend. And I guess we just have to wait till it plays itself out. I don't think that moving in with like an armed, aggressive regime change agenda is going to, you know, do anything for people.
There's another argument. I'm going down the list here, that time is working against us. Every day that we wait, there are people that are suffering under this regime. At the end of the day, what we want is a democratic system with minimized corruption, independent judiciary.
And you can't do that from abroad. You're not in the game. I mean, I saw someone was saying, like, this is a decision people in Iran are going to have to make. You know, this is a game that's inside the country. You can't make this decision from outside. Look at China. Look at, you know, exiles in from China and exiles from, you know, Soviet Russia. You know, let's look at history. What change were they able to bring about? You know, all of these things happened because of circumstances. All the change that's taken place in China, the rise of the middle class, had nothing to do with the Chinese diaspora that went abroad and agitated against the communists. You know, the change that happened in the Soviet Union, the Russian exiles who went off to Paris and London and so on, you know, what impact did they ultimately have on the decline and collapse of the Soviet world?
I see.
Absolutely nothing.
You can't even trigger change or promote, you know, certain activities within the system.
Twitter? Through what? Yeah. Through satellite television channel? You know, I mean, I'm just giving you like really strong historical examples of how exiles had no impact whatsoever on the events of those countries, you know. And Iran is a, you know, revolution on that par of, you know, what happened in China. It's a total change of social formation on par with what happened in China, on the par with what happened in the Soviet Union and so on. And you're just not going to be able to do it from abroad. You got to be inside. You got to play the game.
So what are some of those steps? You mentioned not being as violent against protesters. It seems like the regime is taking some steps. They've arrested some managers of some ministry and for corruption charges.
I mean, that happened in a while. I wouldn't even count that. You know, the corruption is endemic, and like, I don't even think that they would love to fight the corruption. But the big corruption is not like some guy taking a little payment. It's, you know, the fact that, you know, IRGC connected businesses get, you know, the dollar at a certain rate, whereas someone else gets the dollar at another rate. And, you know, no one is really, you know, cracking down on that. You know, I mean, no one is cracking down on the, you know, systemic, endemic, internal corruption of the IRGC and its affiliated businesses.
But can gradual change ultimately lead to secularization or getting to the root of what some of the problems that are in the DNA of the Islamic Republic, you know, having an independent judiciary or having free and fair elections or having someone that's head of state but is fully elected in a very fair way?
No, I don't think gradual change will lead to those things, you know, but I think that, you know, what we can hope for is at some point some kind of internal rupture that forces people to make a decision and forces a dramatic change from within. You know, one example I said is like, you know, the guy, you know, Rouhani's successor becomes supreme leader and he's, you know, a King Philip type, the story of Spain and after, you know, the death of Franco and the king that arose and his, you know, reformist ideas coming into play. I think that's the, you know, the great scenario. That's the best case scenario. What I'm also saying is that I personally really doubt that, you know, external pressure can change a system like Iran's for the better. On the contrary, I think that external pressure works in the favor of the hardliners. I've seen it. I've seen it at work. I've seen how it comes about. You know, you can see it just today with, like, you know, Qasem Soleimani being hailed on, you know, social media and the Iranian press as this great defiant hero because he, you know, stood up and spoke out against Trump and defended the honor of the nation and so on. And I even see, like, you know, some of the exile types kind of admiring his words of kind of his harsh words against Trump. So thanks to Trump, a guy like that becomes like an international figure, becomes empowered even more than he would otherwise.
Historically, there's been a lot of mismanagement and corruption, cronyism with the Islamic Republic. How much of what's happening right now is due to the Trump administration and Trump himself and getting out of the Iran nuclear deal, as opposed to all of these mismanagements and corruption and everything that the Islamic Republic is known to be horrible at?
I would say, like, you know, 60 to 65% of it is like own goal, you know, of the troubles that Iran has right now. I think that the sanctions do have an effect. I think the fact that, you know, the Obama administration as well as the Trump administrations have not been, you know, as helpful as they could be in getting business and investment back to Iran has been a big factor and so on. But, you know, I mean, like, I've talked to, you know, business people who have been in Iran and worked in Iran, like, you know, Dutch, French, German, you know, Italian. And, you know, they all told me the same thing. It's a nightmare doing business in this country.
Yeah.
It's a total effing nightmare. And so, you know, they are, you know, like, you know, the and part of it is cultural. Like, you know, you shake hands, you sign a document, you know, you agree on a price and so on. And then the guy calls you later at night. He's like, no, actually, I want a different deal. He's like, what do you mean? We shook hands. We signed a paper. He's like, yeah, but, you know, I talked to my partners and they aren't in agreement about this. He's like, but you signed the paper. You know, and that happens any part in the Middle East, you know, less and less in some countries. But that happens in the Middle East. They just don't have the same business culture that people in the West are used to. But I think also a lot of it is like, you know, and I can think of many, many examples of people getting into certain sectors, foreign businesses getting into certain sectors and being told after making lots of investment, lots of research and stuff, oh, no, you know. IRGC is in this sector. Sepah is in this sector. You can't get into this sector. It's like, well, why are you telling me this now? It's like, well, you know, so sorry. You know, and, you know, meanwhile, this company has hired like a, you know, consultancy and spent $500,000, has opened a representative office and so on and so forth in Tehran, you know, spent another $500,000. And all of a sudden they're being told this actually this sector is closed to you as a foreigner.
What a nightmare.
So, you know, this is the problem.
How can all of that be changed?
I don't know. I'm not a management consultant, but like I said, you know, you need to, you know, purge. And I think that's one of the interesting things that Rouhani is trying to do, is trying to get, you know, momentum for his plan to get the IRGC out of politics, to get the Sepah out of government and out of business, especially, and bring some measure of normalcy into the business sector and so on. You know, I mean, I think everyone remembers this story, you know, during the last years of the Khatami time, when, you know, the Turkish company had won the contract to start building, you know, Tehran's new airport. What was then Tehran's new airport, Imam Khomeini Airport, it later became. And they were doing the opening ceremony, and the Turks were there, and like a consortium of other businesses were there. They were doing the ribbon cutting when all of a sudden the IRGC pulled up in a bunch of jeeps. And, you know, right in the middle of this thing, I'm not being apocryphal. This actually happened. You can read about it. Pulled up in a bunch of jeeps and basically said, no, this ceremony is not happening.
That's
You're
crazy.
Not building this airport. And this was after they had already won the contract.
Yeah, that's
insane. You can look this up. It's, you know, it was reported back then, like, I don't know, maybe 2003, 2004.
Right.
And so, you know, the IRGC is like, you are not going to build this airport. We're going to get this airport.
That's just crazy. I want to go back to what we talked about earlier on the call about the Pompeo event. You tweeted, this is your tweet, I'm going to read it verbatim. Is it weird that there were literally no Iranian voices at an event called Supporting Iranian Voices? Even the hecklers in the audience were protesting the migrant family separation policy rather than Iran policy, and then you provided a link to the full transcript. And there was a back and forth that you had where you clarified your stance and basically said that nothing happened with Iranians being involved on the record. And then there was this one person, I think you know where I'm going with this, that responded to the thread and said, I was at the speech and I can say Borzoo's tweet is an utter lie generated by NIAC and spread by regime lobbyists and apologists in the U.S. We will shame, all caps, all NIAC scums and pro-IR enthusiasts, I think he meant to say enthusiasts, as they call themselves, just as Nazi scum and ISIS scum are shamed in society today.
I think that's the really sad part.
It's yeah.
Like, you know, you look at the Iranian regime and it's a nightmare. And then you look at the, you know, MEK, MKO, and they're even, trust me, they're an even worse nightmare. You know, I'd rather have a bunch of corrupt mullahs than the Khmer Rouge ruling over me. And then you look at the, you know, so-called secular, you know, exiles and so on. I think they're like insane. And they're totally vitriolic and poisonous. And I mean, there's really no good political options. There's no people that you can rally around. There's no party. There's no, you know, maybe some like, you know, small, tiny, you know, social democrat leftist grouplets that have already faded away in like, you know, whatever, Sweden and Western countries. There's no one like commendable, you know, and this is. And I'll circle back to this for a second, but like, you know, it's really sad. And I think it's one of the reasons why, you know, a couple things happen. Many Iranians do not go into politics. They go into humanities or the STEM and so on and so forth. They do not get involved in this political stuff. The young people are totally turned off by it. Young Iranians, they go into the arts, they go into the, you know, science, they go to NASA, whatever, anything but this crap. And I think another thing is that, to me, this is why it makes the reformists seem so, as flawed as they are, the reformists inside Iran, they seem like so appealing to me, you know, like among the various different groups, you know. And I've hung out with the reformists, I've hung out with like the, you know, Khatami types and so on and so forth. And, you know, as flawed as they are, as weak as they are, as, you know, pathetic as they sometimes are, one, at least they're on the ground inside Iran so they can play. And two, they're actually kind of like, you know, reasonable people who don't like make your blood boil and who aren't like completely insane. Let me give you an example of a, you know, reformist guy that I met. He's very, very pious. He was like a former member of parliament. I went to his house. I'm sorry. I went to his office. It was Ramadan. And, you know, we were just chatting. It wasn't like an interview. Like I was talking to him about a few political things, but it wasn't necessarily going to be an interview. And I had met him before and stuff. And he's like, you know, what do you want? Tea, coffee, sweets and stuff. And I said, it's Ramadan. I don't want to. He's like, yeah, I'm keeping, you know, Ramadan fast. You don't have to. Mm. And he calls his secretary over, brings over tea. And so like just a normal person who's like kind of smart and sophisticated, knows that the foreign journalist is in town, at least knows enough that, you know, you offer tea and coffee because he's not going to be eating. He's not going to be fasting, you know, even though this is like a Iranian himself, he's not going to be fasting. And, you know, I want to at least give the impression that I'm open enough and open minded enough that, you know, you can eat in front of me and I'm not like this sort of zealot. You know, to me, that was like a sort of impressive moment where I'm like, that's kind of interesting. These reformists are not, you know, so hopeless and hapless, you know, and so I don't know. I mean, you know.
But when people hear that, they start lashing out. They're like, "Oh, you're a mouthpiece for the Islamic Republic. That just means you do you like the reformists, and reformists are part of the bigger picture in the Islamic Republic, and therefore."
I didn't say I like them, but I'm saying when I put them side by side with those various people, you know, and you know, put a reformist and that guy who calls me a mouthpiece and a, you know, regime hardliner and an MKO crazy and one of these, you know, old fogey pro Shah people, put them in a room, have them debate, you know,
right.
Let's see who comes off as the most impressive and the most sort of reasonable and connected to the, you know, is sort of a pious guy, but still is sophisticated, is, you know what I'm saying?
Yeah. Like, yeah.
Those people are at least sane. You know, the guy who says that you're a regime mouthpiece, et cetera, you're working for NIAC and stuff. I think the guy needs therapy. You know,
so
I think that guy needs, like, sort of, you know, like before he gets into politics, he needs to work on some personal growth and anger management issues.
I agree. I don't doubt that person, like, truly cares for the future of Iran or whatever. But the fact that he lashes out like that and is not willing to engage in good faith. Is
my
a problem.
Sort of jokey, it's at my sort of jokey tweet that was like put in a form of a question mark and was more marveling at the fact that even the hecklers were not heckling about Iran. They were heckling about family separation policy.
Yeah. First of all, he completely was unwilling to acknowledge the clarification that you provided. And then he resorted to insults and basically saying you're a Nazi sympathizer in so many words, right? It's yeah. Anyway, I think that's the part of the problem. That's part of the reason I think we need to have a forum like this where we can actually parse out these ideas and let the best ideas win.
Yeah, I mean, you know, you should talk to Ervand Ibrahimian. You should talk to some of those, like, smart scholars. I know that, like, what's her name? That woman in Hawaii, Farideh. What's her name? Fatideh. I know her as Fatideh, the scholar in Hawaii.
Okay.
You know, really smart person, you know, really interesting people. You know, you get some, you know, younger voices in there as well. But, you know, there are people in the diaspora who are, you know, speakable to. And I think one thing that would be really interesting, I can give you, if you go on my, you know, and I'll put this out there for people who are listening on the podcast. If you go to my, you know, Twitter account, you go to my lists, Twitter lists, there's a list of you know, I call it the Iran list, and there's a list of, you know, Iranian scholars, experts, politicians, even, you know, MKO people as well as others. And, you know, on that list there's you know, a bunch of really interesting people that you can use as a resource, including some English-speaking people in Iran. Wouldn't it be interesting to have you know, like a sort of not a pragmatist conservative, you know, not quite a hardliner, who speaks perfect English, you know, speaking on this show and having a debate with him. Having a season. Yeah. But you look on that list, you'll find some people in there that fit that bill that would be good to have, you know, just to have it as part of the dialogue.
Yeah, but I would also like to have some regime change people on the podcast as well, just to, you know, hear the other side.
Those are easy to find, and they talk easily, and they're on VOA all the time.
I want to be objective. I want every idea to be heard. You know, I want people to make their own decisions, you know.
Absolutely.
Yeah. So just one last thing. What can people in the diaspora actually do? You know, what are some of those steps, some tangible steps that Iranian Americans can take?
I think, first of all, people need to, like, actually read and hear about what's going on in Iran. And that means going to primary sources to a certain extent, you know, and not just relying for news on, you know, English language Twitter feeds of and Telegram pages of people in the diaspora.
Right.
And, you know, sort of it becomes a sort of emotional game where it's about, like, you know, look at these women, they're taking off their hijab, the revolution is starting, and so on and so forth. But, like, you know, actually interesting to read some of the websites and blogs and news wires inside the country to see how these things are having an impact. And they are having an impact, but to see what the conversation is like inside the country. To read, you know, some of the more interesting conservative and hardline outlets and see what rhetorical tricks they use, see how they, you know, kind of regard the people in the diaspora and just sort of, you know, at least be informed about what they're saying and, you know, see what their arguments are, because sometimes they make better arguments than the people. And this is what shocks me, like, you know, to listen to Qasem Soleimani and, you know, to be like sort of nodding in agreement and laughing at his sense of humor, his moxie and his sort of, you know, pretty correct analysis of what's going on. You sent hundreds of tanks and tons of helicopters and 110,000 troops into Afghanistan for the past 10 years. What did you get out of it? You're begging the Taliban for talks. I mean, he was like dead on, you know, and sort of describing the U.S. kind of dilemma and the, you know, U.S. failures in the region. He's like, so what? Why are you threatening us? What do you? What game are you trying to play? What do you really want to do this? You know, do you really want to play this game? And we're ready for it. You know, and I don't know if they're ready for it, but I'm just saying the rhetoric is interesting. Listening to it is interesting. Taking it seriously is important. So, you know, that's what I would say to people in the diaspora. Step one is to just actually know what's going on.
Makes sense.
Which I feel many people in the diaspora, they have no clue what's going on.
Right. Right.
They're living in a sort of weird bubble where, you know, any moment for the last 40 years, you know, regime change and the collapse of the regime are imminent. You know, I'm a little bit older than you, you know. I've been watching this thing since I was, you know, a kid that was old enough to read and watch TV and understand everything that's going on, you know. And, you know, I can tell you that, like, every single month the regime is about to fall for the last 40 effing years.
Yeah, yeah. Borzi, you've been very generous with your time.
Thank you.
I really appreciate it. I can imagine how busy you are these days. So,
yeah.
Thanks.
All right.
Bye-bye. You too. Bye. All right. Thanks for listening. I hope you found that episode to be productive and interesting. If you did, please share it with your family and friends. And review the podcast on iTunes or any of the other platforms. And stay tuned for a lot more great guests coming up. Thanks and take care.